We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Lots to cover in our disintegrating society and world.
This week. And a cheerful weekend to you, too.
Yes.
Let's start out with police accountability news.
Okay. So this week, the six-member jury in the Charlina Lyles inquest issued a verdict. They determined that officers Jason Anderson and Stephen McNew, did not violate Seattle Police Department policy, and that they used reasonable force when they shot and killed Charlina Lyles in the kitchen of her home back in 2017. The jury did find that Stephen McNew violated department policy by not carrying his stun gun with him. And so why they didn't go on and find that he had violated police department policy by shooting Lyles, I don't know. But the jury determined that the stun gun would not have been effective at subduing Lyles when she pulled a paring knife and threatened Jason Anderson. They came to this conclusion because Lyles was wearing a long, heavy coat at the time, and they assumed that using a stun gun wouldn't have worked. I don't know. Now, it's worth noting that police reform activists have criticized the Seattle Police Department's policies on how to treat people with knives or other sharp objects. For example, the policies assume that any size knife wielded by any size person is an imminent and very serious threat. The jury was specifically asked if the officers violated department policy, and the jury was not asked if those policies are reasonable. Okay. So that's one of the major limitations of the inquest.
Yeah. Process. And historically, the inquest policy always favors the police department. It's really rigged to determine that shootings are justified, no matter what. I mean, that's historically been the pattern for decades. And, you know, police accountability activists have been trying for years and years to get the inquest process to be more fair. For instance, you know, there is no ability for the family of the deceased to call witnesses or ask questions even. It's very stacked in favor of the police department, unfortunately.
And King County has been working to try to make changes to its inquest system. This is one of the first cases to be heard under the new inquest system. The family of Charlina Lyles were able to hire a lawyer who was able to participate in the inquest. But again, the jury was asked a series of yes or no questions. And the point of the inquest really was to try to determine whether or not prosecutors, King County prosecutors, should pursue a case against either of the two or both of the officers involved in the shooting. And that's going to be a decision that will come fairly soon, I think, but hasn't come yet. My guess is that there isn't going to be a case, and it'll be up to the family of Charlina Lyles to pursue a civil case if they want to and they have the resources. Now, Mayor Bruce Harrell this week issued a statement calling Lyles' killing a quote-unquote tragic event, and he referred to the need for more reforms and improvements within the police department, but he made no mention of any specific reforms that might have prevented Lyles' death, like a review of SPD's policy on how to treat people who are going through a mental health crisis, because officers knew that Lyles had a mental health history and was a frequent flyer on the 911 call system. And they should have had her flagged as needing mental health specialists there to work with her. And another change in their policies would involve how you treat people with knives. Okay.
Funny you should mention Bruce Harrell because, of course, Lyle's death was in 2017. This is before George Floyd. But there was a lot of community protests around Lyle's death. And so much so that the city council convened a special hearing at UW, I think UW Law School, one of the auditoriums on campus, which is close.
It was at Kane Hall.
Oh, it was at Kane Hall. Okay. It's relatively close to where Lyle's was killed. And I remember, Mike, I think you were there too. I was there. And I remember Harrell, who was then on city council, being one of the most vociferous defenders of SPD's actions at that evening. And so now he's calling it a tragedy.
Well, he remains one of the local politicians who is still very supportive of the police. So even after the George Floyd shooting and major protests against SPD use of force policies, and during the whole George Floyd protests, when Harrell was running for mayor, he came out and he said, you know, oh gosh, what I would do is just make everybody in the Seattle Police Department watch a video and take a pledge not to shoot people. Yeah, that was his response.
I shouldn't laugh. I really shouldn't.
That was his response to questions during campaign forums of what would you do to further police reform in Seattle.
Yeah, so, on second thought, I should laugh.
It's
really pathetic. Yeah.
So that's where he stands. So that was the outcome in the Charlena Lyles inquest. Now, also this week, King County Executive Dow Constantine and the new King County Sheriff, Patty Cole Tyndall, who's been in that position for just a couple of months, they announced this week that they are reorganizing the King County Sheriff's Office, changing it from a 3-division department to a 5-division department. In addition, Constantine will set up a new community advisory board, although he didn't release details of who would be on the board and how it would operate, other than to say that it will consult with the community and advise him and Cole Tyndall on improvements to the sheriff's department and its policies. So I'm thinking he will be modeling it on the Community Police Commission here in Seattle. Now, that board will be housed under the executive's office. That's Constantine's office, not the sheriff's department. Okay. Now, the two new departments within the sheriff's department will be a new community programs division, which will consult with community groups, like, for example, the NAACP and community passageways, to figure out how the sheriff's department can refer people in crisis to the services that they need. The second new department will be the Special Operations Division, which will house the SWAT team, the Marine unit, the Air Patrol, the Bomb Squad, and crisis negotiators. And then the other three divisions will remain the same. That's Technical Services and Support, Patrol Operations, and Criminal Investigations. So Constantine and Tyndall, Cole Tyndall, hard at work to try to remodel the King County Sheriff's Department after I sounds to me like this, like the SPD.
Mm. Yeah, because SPD's accountability mechanisms have been so effective.
Yes. I think it's an effort to try to avoid any further scrutiny of the King County Sheriff's Department. We'll see if this works.
Yeah, and the details of who is on that commission and, you know, who they report to and what their charge is, those are all very important, and we don't know those yet.
Yeah, and I'm sure those will be coming soon. Now, also this week, the Seattle Times reported that the new State Office of Independent Investigations, which was supposed to open on July 1st, will be delayed for several months. The state legislature passed a bill to create the new statewide office to investigate police accountability cases and how they're handled by local agencies, in Washington state. the new Office of Independent Investigations will have the authority to investigate those cases and present their findings publicly and make recommendations to county prosecutors. So it's an additional layer of investigation when, for example, the inquest system isn't working, or when other ways of handling complaints against the police in a local jurisdiction are not working out. Okay. There will be this state office. Now, the timeline for setting up the office, I think, may have been too optimistic, you know, given the pandemic and the fact that so many people have resigned from their jobs, particularly so many baby boomers retiring and not enough people to replace them. The state has had some difficulty hiring enough experienced investigators and staff to get the office off the ground. In addition, the new staff is going to have to write up policies and procedures and figure out how the office, the new OII, will operate. Currently, the new head of the office is Roger Rogoff. He's a former Superior Court judge and former King County prosecutor. He's the one who gave the interview to the Seattle Times saying, nope, we're not ready to open and start work yet. So we'll see. Hopefully they'll get underway in the coming months, and it won't be a year or more before the OII is working. So that wraps up police accountability news for this week.
Okay. So also this week, city council news.
Yeah. So the city council did not get the 6 votes that it needed to overturn Mayor Bruce Harrell's veto of Council Bill 120325, which was Alex Peterson's bill to require landlords to report how much rent they're charging for their apartments in Seattle. The vote was taken. It was 5-3 with Teresa Mosqueda absent. Okay. Now, before the vote, Alex Peterson spoke in support of the bill that he sponsored. He said that this data is needed before the city draws up a new comprehensive plan, and he detailed the changes that the council had made to the bill to address complaints raised by landlords and by Mayor Harrell. And he had offered to make additional changes to the bill after Harrell vetoed it, but had not heard back from his office. Peterson especially highlighted that the costs of the bill were much lower than critics had said, and that the data would not be collected by city government, a major complaint of landlords, okay, but by a research university. Now, the data collection would just be added on to a data collection program that already exists, the Rental Housing Registration Program. He urged other council members who initially opposed the bill to change their minds and vote yes. Tammy Morales then spoke up and highlighted she was the co-sponsor of the bill. She highlighted that this information would empower tenants to shop for better deals when they look for a new apartment, and they would know who actually owns their building and how to hold those landlords accountable for repairs. And it's interesting she spoke on behalf of tenants in that way, because I think that this is the main reason why landlords hate the bill. Right. Shama Sawant also then spoke for the bill, and she pointed out that several folks publicly testifying that day had pointed out that if landlords are not dodging their tenants, then why are they embarrassed to discuss what they charge for rent? Good point. She also spoke.
Zing.
Yeah, she also spoke for rent control and social housing, and pointed out that tenants will be pushing for rent control regardless of how the council votes on this bill. So if landlords think that this is a way to stop that wave from happening, they're wrong. So there was Sawant waving the flag to be the standard bearer for tenants again. Herbold also spoke for the bill in terms of its value for data collection. She talked about how the city council has used things like displacement risk analyses and other data tools to guide their past decisions on previous comprehensive plans, zoning decisions, new policies to avoid displacement, and council decisions on how much to fund affordable housing. Excuse me. Then of course the vote was taken, and voting for the bill were Herbold Lewis, Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, Alex Peterson, and Sawant. voting against were Deborah Juarez and Sarah Nelson, the expected no votes, and Dan Strauss. Teresa Mosqueda, again, was absent. But she didn't support the bill the first time around for cost reasons. Now, it's really too bad that she wasn't there, because she and Dan Strauss, I think, were considered the swing votes. And I think everyone who voted for the bill were deeply disappointed that Dan Strauss still voted no, and he made no comments as to why. He made no comments the first time around, and he made no comments the second time about why he didn't support the bill. So that's a bit of a mystery, and I think something that residents of Seattle should ask him about next time he's up for election.
And I think it'll be very interesting to see where his donations come from next time.
Yeah, and of course, Deborah Juarez didn't postpone the vote until all 9 council members were there, a move that I think we could have expect, that was pretty much expected from her, since she didn't like the bill either. And she's very pro-business and would always come down on the side of landlords, just like Sarah Nelson, and not on the side of tenants. So I just want to point out, too, that when Mayor Harrell vetoed the bill, he said that the amount of rent that landlords charge is, quote, proprietary information. And that's in spite of the fact that the amount that people pay to purchase houses, and that real estate developers get when they sell houses and condos, is not proprietary information. And that this is just one of many ways in which people with higher incomes in our society, who can afford to buy versus rent, have greater privileges, especially when it comes to information that's needed in order to make very serious and important financial decisions.
Well, it's important to remember, too, that Harrell is an attorney.
Yes.
So that speaks a lot to those who are represented.
Yes, and I think the last time I looked at his statement, I think annually the city does disclosure of politicians' financial statements. I think annually they're required to make financial statements to the city to disclose any kind of conflicts of interest or anything. And I think the last time I looked at his, he actually owns rental properties. So I think Harrell is himself a landlord, or he may have been in the past if he's not now. So, of course, he's also going to side with landlords. So, and I just want to mention, in terms of the City Council, this coming week, the Public Safety and Human Services Committee will meet. And that's the committee that oversees the Seattle Police Department, chaired by Lisa Herbold. And they may vote on a new bill that would specify how complaints against the chief of police will be investigated and handled. They've been considering amendments and voting on those, and it may come to a final vote to move it on to the full council. If they do this coming week, then the soonest it would be voted on by the full council is, I believe, the week of January 18th or 19th. Okay. And also on the agenda for this coming week in the Public Safety and Human Services Committee are presentations on the Seattle Police Department Race and Social Justice Initiative, and presentations on 2 programs that are important parts of the city's community safety response. The Youth Link program — Link stands for Leadership, Intervention, and Change — and the King County Regional Approach for Gun Violence Prevention. So I think that's going to be a very, very interesting meeting. So just pointing that out for folks.
A clarifying question. You said the upcoming vote could be January 18th or 19th. Did you mean July?
Or January? Oh, I'm sorry, July. Okay. Not January, July.
Okay. Does that seem a ways off?
It's been a really warm winter.
I haven't had my second cup of tea yet today. Okay. So.
All right. No problem.
I should know I need to get fully caffeinated before I do the program.
No worries. All right. Anything else under council news? All right.
No, that was council news this week.
All right. A report out on wage increases?
Yeah. This week, the Washington State Employment Security Department released news about wage growth in 2021. Every year they release their information about wages for the prior year. And they just, it usually hits about the middle of the next year. So this past week, they released news about wage growth for 2021. Wages in Washington state grew an average of 7.4% to an average of $82,508 per year. That's across the entire state. Okay. But the growth was not evenly distributed around the state, right? The largest increase was in King County, of course, which was only, and interestingly, it was only second in the entire nation for wage growth in terms of all the counties across the United States. Here in King County,
out of about 3,000 counties.
Yeah, it's amazing. Here in King County, wages grew by 24% last year. Let that sink in. That was almost one quarter, right? To a new average of $115,436. That's the average wage in King County. Now, while 30% of Washington State's total population lives in King County, not everyone saw their wages grow by that much, right? The biggest winners were real estate. So I'm going to name the sectors. Real estate was right there up at the top. Scientific and technical jobs. IT, that's everybody working in computer and computer tech, and finance and insurance. Okay.
Man, my wages sure didn't rise by that much.
I know. In addition, and I want to point out too that in addition to getting big increases in 2021, those jobs in those sectors also saw an average of 21 to 30% wage increases in 2020. Okay. So let that sink in. Yes. Now, the largest one-year growth last year happened in the hospitality and food service sector. But unlike those other four sectors that I named, the hospitality and food service industry suffered a big downturn in 2020 with the pandemic. So those workers really deserved a big bump in their wages because they're trying to make up a big shortfall from the prior year. Now, the smallest wage growth, which was around 1 to 4% last year, was in the following sectors: manufacturing, education, including teachers, arts and entertainment. That's all the folks who have had to not go on tour, perform live, et cetera, during the pandemic, right? And government jobs, and that includes government workers and utility workers. The median hourly wage in the state of Washington is $25 across the entire state. Here in King County, the median wage, so everyone makes, half of everyone makes above that and half of everyone makes below that. Here in King County, it's $40.48. But the median hourly wage in the Seattle metropolitan area grew by only 2% in 2021. In the meantime, the consumer price index grew by 5% in that same time frame. So wages, even though it looks like everybody's getting a big bump in pay, right? Wages are really not keeping up with rising costs, particularly here in Seattle. Okay. So that's what I gleaned from the Washington State Employment Security Department's report on wages.
Okay. Well, that seems to mesh with my concept of reality. So,
yeah. So kind of good to get the numbers every once in a while to put things in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Just so you can know how fast the, that swirl that's sucking us all down the drain is going.
Mike, I love your optimism.
All right. Well, let's move on to more good news this week.
One of the things I've been noticing when I look at the city council is I've been noticing a lot of reappointments to different boards and things. And one of the things that went through the city council this week were reappointments to the Green New Deal Oversight Board. And I was thinking, I wonder what the Green New Deal Oversight Board is up to. Right. So I checked into that. Now, the board was set up by the city council to make recommendations to the mayor and council on ways to transition to a green economy by the year 2030 and still adhere to the city's race, social justice, and equity goals. I noticed that several of those board members are returning board members, which is, I think, a sign that the Green New Deal Oversight Board is making some kind of progress and is is a functional agency, not a dysfunctional agency. Typically, when a group is not functioning, there's a lot of infighting or it's not getting anything done or people think they're wasting their time. You'll see a lot of resignations and empty spots. But I'm not seeing that with the Green New Deal Oversight Board. And about a month ago, they released their recommendations for what they would like the mayor and city council to include in the upcoming 2023 budget. The mayor is expected to release his draft budget in September, and the city council will review and make changes and then vote on a final budget just before Thanksgiving in late November. So some of the things, not all of the things, but some of the things that the Green New Deal Oversight Board are recommending include doubling the size of the Clean Heat Program, which helps low-income households transition off of oil heat. So they recommend doubling it from $2 million in 2022 to $4 million in 2023. They would add $400,000 for Indigenous-led sustainability programs, including projects focused on local food sovereignty. They are recommending $4 million for climate resilience hubs. These are places where people can go during massive heat waves, and that includes money to identify city buildings that could be turned into air-conditioned spaces for people to escape a heat wave. They would add $300,000 to the city's Environmental Justice Fund, which helps community groups with urban farming, habitat restoration, and other green projects. They're recommending $1 million for workforce development apprenticeship programs to train and place people, including BIPOC youth, into clean energy jobs, and they are expecting those jobs to be union jobs. They recommend $4.5 million to fund the Clean Buildings Accelerator Program to help under-resourced building owners to adapt their buildings to the state's clean energy building standards. This should include buildings that house BIPOC and low-income folks and existing affordable housing, some of which are run by nonprofits who often don't have the financial resources to invest in making big capital improvements like upgrading buildings, adding solar panels, installing windows that are energy efficient, that kind of thing. They are also recommending $2 million for a program to help lower income homeowners make similar clean energy improvements, which would help homeowners that make 120% of area median income and below. So it's not just targeted at low income homeowners, but also middle income homeowners with an understanding that even people in the quote unquote middle class don't have a lot of money just laying around to make big capital improvements on their home. And this program would help, would include helping them to find financing options that they can afford. Okay. On top of whatever their finances currently are. And they also are recommending about $2 million for transitioning the city government and transitioning businesses and Seattleites from gas-guzzling cars to electric vehicles. Okay. And there are other smaller programs on the list. A lot of these programs, it's nice to see, are already underway or the council has expressed interest in doing them but hasn't found the money yet in the city budget to fund them. With the pandemic and an expected budget shortfall this year, we'll see how many of these items actually make it into Mayor Harrell's proposal and the City Council's final budget. But it's really good to see that there is a group that is advocating already for these programs in a coordinated way.
Stick a pin in those recommendations and we'll see how many of them actually make it to the final budget in November.
Yeah. But like I said, it's really nice to see a group that is really advocating for them already and isn't down to a community, environmental groups or individuals trying to push these programs to the city council. There's actually a group that's evaluating what's working, what's not, where the council should be concentrating and making recommendations and pushing for them. So. And the Green New Deal Oversight Board is still kind of getting underway. They just adopted their bylaws and their mission/values statement late last year. And they're currently drafting a work plan. They meet about every 2 weeks. So you can get more information on their website at seattle.gov. And it's /. And then it's Green New Deal Oversight Board with dashes in between each of those words. So green-new-deal-oversight-board.
All right.
So that's my wrap-up of what they're up to.
Well, let's move on to this week's pandemic news, which appears to be percolating up again.
Yeah, we are still in a pandemic, and it's getting worse. The subvariant BA.5, which along with BA.4 now makes about 70% of cases nationally. The BA.5 one is looking to be particularly problematic, initial studies coming out show. That makes up about 53% of national cases. And it appears to be potentially more virulent, as well as being more what they're calling immune evasive, which is to say, if you've had vaccines or if you've had COVID in the past, that may not protect you from this particular subvariant. I personally know a lot of people who have COVID right now. So it's going around both nationally and locally. You know, you're seeing that in terms of local regulations as well. New York City's cases are up 17% in the last 2 weeks. Los Angeles County is looking at reinstituting a mask mandate for indoor public spaces by the end of the month, if the current growth in new cases continues. So, again, we are still in a pandemic. Europe cases are surging. They're being driven by BA4 and BA5, and often Europe has been a precursor to similar kind of surges in North America. And this in particular is telling because, of course, Europe is in the middle of summer, as is North America, and in 20 and 2021, cases dropped during the summer. That is not the case in 2022. And so any kind of surge that we have this coming fall or any new subvariants, it's going to be that much worse. So the pandemic continues. We continue to recommend wearing masks in indoor public spaces and maybe even in outdoor spaces if you're particularly vulnerable to the virus. And unfortunately our elected officials and even our health departments have decided to pretend that the pandemic is over, and it is not. People want it to be because they're understandably tired of it, but it's still going. So take precautions as warranted.
Yeah, it's crazy the different reports I'm reading about it on social media.
I think one of the major vectors of the virus is travel.
Mm-hmm.
I think
yes.
I'm not planning to do any travel during my vacations this year because I'm just not comfortable getting on an airplane with recirculated air and a number of people not wearing their masks. It's important to remember that COVID-19 can be spread by people who have no symptoms. Okay.
Yeah.
And not everyone is going to spend the $10 to buy a COVID-19 test and do a test before they go onto a plane, a bus, or a train.
The other thing that is important is that even though you may be asymptomatic, you're still vulnerable. About 20% of people get long COVID, and that can be debilitating and last We don't know how long because, you know, some people are still suffering from it. So, you know, long COVID is a serious issue as well. And it's, you know, they're trying to study it, but it seems like an indefinite problem at this point. I was watching a TV segment, God help me, last night, where people were being interviewed in Southern California because of the potential for mask mandates in LA. And they're hanging out at the beach and say, oh yeah, well, we didn't get a vacation the last couple of years, so we decided we just had to have a vacation this year. Well, you know, honey, I really hope the TV crew comes back and interviews you when you're sick as a dog in 2 weeks. Because that, you know, that's the kind of thing that's happening. And people are just oblivious.
And
media is a big part of the problem because they also have decided to give up on covering COVID as a serious issue.
Well, and then I kind of always wonder when people say, oh, I got so sick, but I've been so careful. You know? And I'm like, have you been anywhere indoors or outdoors with people who are not wearing their mask? In particularly outdoors in a big crowd where you're very close to people who are not wearing their masks. And typically the answer is, well, yeah, but I was wearing a mask and it's like, doesn't matter. That's probably when you got it.
Well, they checked people before they let them into the concert. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And all 10,000 people told the truth, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's discouraging for sure. So yeah, be careful because we know our listeners are smarter than that.
Yep.
We hope you are.
Yes.
We know you are.
But I would point out that none of the three of us have gotten COVID so far. So
that I know of. I always have to say that I know of. I'm pretty sure Job hasn't. Or he would have probably gotten very sick. I'm pretty sure that I have not had it. It's possible I had it at the very beginning, way back in February 2020. I was very sick. But that was before the lockdown.
Right. And that was before we really knew how it was spread.
Yeah, before. And when they were telling us, just wash your hands. Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly before any vaccines were available.
Yeah, and there was a person in my office who had a family member in a group care situation, and her family member got very, very sick. So it's possible that that could have been the route of spread for me, or I might have gotten it on public transit. But, you know, I mean, there have been enough variants since that if I hadn't been careful, I might have gotten it a second or even a third time. There are people who have gotten sick more than twice. So yeah. I have not had that happen yet. And my fingers are crossed. And I'm hoping it doesn't happen until the virus is in a much less lethal form.
All right. Let's move on. Updates this week on the January 6th committee.
Yeah, a lot going on, even though there were no hearings this week. Pat Cipollone, the former White House counsel, who reportedly, according to Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony last week, had told Trump on multiple occasions that, you know, you can't do that. It's illegal. Finally gave in and testified for 8 hours yesterday behind closed doors to the committee. You don't testify for 8 hours to plead the fifth 120 times. It's likely at least some of that testimony was substantive. So, we may or may not hear what Cipollone had to say. They could choose to show segments of his testimony by video, as they have with other previous interviewees, or they could include it in their final report. The committee is going to have a couple of hearings next week, and it should make a lot of news. The hearing on Tuesday will cover the potential coordination between the White House and various right-wing neo-fascist groups like the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, etc. The committee has sort of been circling around that topic for the last few weeks. And given the reporting that's come out around that, I expect that to be pretty explosive. And then there will be what's ostensibly a final hearing on Thursday, probably in prime time. Then I'm sure they're saving the best for last. But given that they are still taking testimony from various witnesses like Cipollone, it may not be the last hearing. Now, Congress itself adjourns for its summer recess at the end of July. So we will see if there are any additional hearings after next week. But I expect we'll be talking a lot about those hearings next week in our show.
All right. Well,
oh, and I should mention also in the Trump crime saga that the New York Times broke the story this week that both James Comey and I believe it was James McCabe, his successor heading the FBI, were audited by Trump's IRS department when they crossed Trump by not doing his bidding. And basically using the FBI to as Trump's personal law enforcement agency. They refused to do that, and so they got what were described as intrusive audits by the IRS, the sorts of audits that maybe 1 in 10,000 people get. So, once again, another example of criminality in the Trump administration that will probably never be prosecuted. But should be.
Yeah, it's quite the long list.
It really is.
Yes, it is.
All right. Let's move on and talk a little about the mass shooting in...
To fill in the blank. Yeah.
Yeah.
Highland Park, Illinois. Yeah. Which happens to be right across the street from where I went to high school. I mean, literally, you cross the street and you're in Highland Park. So I know that area pretty well. And the description of Highland Park by media was a little misleading. It was described as an affluent, mostly white suburb. That's partially true. Highland Park is on the shore of Lake Michigan. And the area, it's like Seattle. The area right by the shore of the lake is very affluent and very white. The area farther inland is working class and mixed. And it was from that area that the shooter and his father and uncle, who he lived with, they lived in that area. Now, the thing that was interesting about the shooter, there's not that much that's interesting. I mean, he's a young white guy. It's always a young white guy, or almost always. But he had been very open on social media about his plans, not specifically his plans to shoot up a 4th of July parade, but his desire to kill a lot of people. And he also had a history of having weapons, in this case knives and a sword, confiscated by local police because he was, you know, threatening to use them to hurt people. That was 3 years ago, but he was still able, despite what have been described as Illinois' relatively stringent gun laws, to walk into a sporting goods store and legally purchase an AR-15. If that strikes you as insane, it should. Again, even if Illinois tightened up that particular loophole. He's 30 miles from Indiana. He's 20 miles from Wisconsin, and Wisconsin and Indiana both have much less stringent gun laws than Illinois. So in a situation like that, where somebody is relatively close to a state line, they can cross a state line, and you see this all the time in New York and D.C. and other East Coast cities. You can cross a state line to a state with less stringent gun laws and take advantage of those. This is notorious in D.C., which has very stringent gun control laws, but you can go across the river, Potomac River, to Virginia, which has almost no restrictions at all. So this once again underscored the sheer insanity of the United States' lack of gun control and lack of and gun safety laws.
And the need for federal action for the U.S. Congress to pass laws to really bring the gun control laws kind of into uniformity all across the United States, not this patchwork.
And, of course, there's all kinds of issues where patchwork is the problem, where, you know, you're seeing this mass difference from state to state, you know, voter registration requirements, for example. You know, you saw a court ruling in Wisconsin this week that made drop boxes, basically banned drop boxes for voting, which is, you know, ridiculous because a lot of people use drop boxes. And since the federal government, under Donald Trump, more or less dismantled the postal service, drop boxes are by far the most secure way to get your ballot in. But, they don't want that. They want you using the mail, which can be easily lost and et cetera, et cetera. So it's another voter suppression tactic. And, not to get too far off on the tangent, but until you get a national standard for basic voting rights for people, you're going to continue to see half the country's states, the ones that are controlled by Republicans, trying to suppress the vote, because that's the only way they can consistently win elections, particularly at the federal level. So, yeah, it's a serious problem with gun safety. We also saw a serious police shooting this not this past week, national news this past week in Akron, Ohio, just outside Cleveland, where a 25-year-old young black man named Jalen Walker was shot by police. Police attempted to pull him over for a traffic stop for a broken taillight, quote unquote. And anybody who's familiar with pre-check stops knows that this is like one of the most common things the police cite. And the taillight may or may not have been broken.
In other words, so driving while black.
Yeah, basically. And he fled from the police, which if he was fearful, he did have a gun in the car, which was legally registered. Police claimed that he fired the gun from the car at them, although there was no, you know, there was no broken bullet holes to indicate that he fired through a window at all. So it's, and we haven't heard, which probably tells you all you need to know. We have not heard from police officials in Akron as to whether the gun was actually fired. In any event, he eventually, came to a rolling stop in a, parking lot and then jumped out of the car and fled on foot without the gun. He was not armed and he was shot in the back 60 times. Police fired 90 rounds. They hit him 60 times. 8 different officers opened fire on him. So this escalated from a traffic stop into 60 rounds hitting the young man. And, of course, he was, you know, shot to a pulp. So there have been more or less daily protests in Akron ever since this shooting happened in late June. So it's been 2 weeks since the shooting happened. And, it's been a huge story in Northeast Ohio, but not so much nationally, which, tells you, you know, how much the tenor has changed from 2 years ago, from 2 summers ago, because this would have been a huge story in the summer of 2020. 2022, apparently not so much, but it's a very tragic situation. And, you know, the city of Akron has not been particularly forthcoming with details so far on the shooting. But by all accounts, this was a young man minding his business. He was a DoorDash delivery guy. No record, no criminal history, no mental health history, nothing.
And for folks who are always wondering, you know, why when you're being pulled over by the cops, do these guys run? I think it's important to understand the psychology of what it means to be a young black man in America. And for white folks, it's important to try to understand what that is so that you can understand why folks run when they see flashing blue lights in the rearview mirror. I just finished reading a novel that won the National Book Award last year called Hell of a Book by Jason Mott. And if you want to know what that kind of psychology is all about and you want to know how to understand and empathize, I would highly recommend that book for you to read in the coming months. It's called Hell of a Book by Jason Mott, M-O-T-T. So if you're having trouble understanding why when a young black man is out driving, he sees flashing blue lights in the rearview mirror, why he might step on the accelerator rather than step on the brake, that's the book for you.
Yeah. Meantime, also in a police accountability news nationally this week, Derek Chauvin, remember him? He was the police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd. He was also facing federal civil rights charges for violating George Floyd's civil rights. And he pleaded guilty to those charges, and he was sentenced this week to 20-plus years in federal prison. That sentence will run concurrently with his state prison sentence for murdering George Floyd. So he's going to be an old man by the time he is out of prison. He will have to serve at least 18 years of that sentence. So you won't have to think about Derek Chauvin again for a good long while. And likely he will spend a lot of that in isolation because he is likely to face serious danger from other federal prisoners.
If he's in the general population.
If he's in the general population. So that didn't make a lot of national news because there was a lot else going on this week. But I thought that was worth pointing out also, just as sort of what Paul Harvey used to call the end of the story.
All right. Moving on, former Prime Minister Abe in
Shinzo Abe. He was the longest serving Prime Minister in modern Japanese history, and he was assassinated abruptly at a campaign rally on Friday. And has been widely reported, of course. The thing that was remarkable about that assassination is that the assassin used a homemade gun, and that firearms deaths are extremely rare in Japan. Now, how rare are they? There was one firearms-related death in Japan, a country of about 140 million people, in 2021. By comparison, there were about 45,000 in the United States. That's not counting accidents and suicides. Japan has very stringent gun laws. And before Ted Cruz starts complaining about, well, this shows that gun control doesn't work, blah, 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 blah.
Let me take a moment to laugh.
Yes. The guy, or weep, as the case may be. You know, you have to pick your motive of
your
choice.
Your response, yeah.
Yes. The guy was a former military guy who had weapons training and was able to assemble a homemade weapon. And, you know, this is also a danger in the United States, is that people are going to start using not just the ghost guns that people are talking about, where they use 3D printers to, you know, produce a firearm, but people who can improvise a homemade weapon like that. There's more and more technology able to do that. Apparently, this discharged electrically, and you know, basically used duct tape and plastic piping to pull a weapon together. The other thing that should be pointed out is that firearm deaths or violence of all kinds in terms of violent crime are so rare that former prime ministers like Abe had had a couple bodyguards around them. That was it. There's no permanent lifetime Social Security detail, or I mean Secret Service detail. There's no You know, there's no taxpayer-funded security detail around elected officials for the rest of their lives, the way there is in the United States, where we have violent crime all the time. So, you know, if you want to meet a former prime minister, you can probably just walk up to him and not go through any kind of security screening at all. That's likely to change now. Japan is a very peaceful country to live in. I can testify to that because I lived there a couple different times in my life. And, you know, you just don't worry about personal safety. You know, you can go walking around a big city like Tokyo or Osaka at 2 a.m. and not have to worry about personal safety at all.
Or worry about sending your kid off to school.
Yeah, it's simply unheard of. So, so you know, this is going to be a really earth-shattering event in the history of modern Japan. And it was a major global event also because Abe had been in office for a total of about 10 years in four different terms. And, you know, knew most of the world leaders of this century. Yeah, there's a lot of outpourings of expressions of condolences and thoughts and prayers and so forth. But, it will be interesting to see what this does to the security situation in East Asia. Abe was known as a nationalist and somebody who was a very pro-Japanese military. That's a very fraught domestic issue in Japan, which has a post-World War II constitution that guarantees that the military cannot be used for overseas missions. Abe sought unsuccessfully, at least so far, to change that. And certainly the security threat posed by China and to a lesser extent North Korea, you know, calls that into question now. And we'll see whether in the wake of Abe's assassination that there's the momentum to change that in Japan. Certainly that's something the United States has been pushing for a number of years. So we'll see if that happens. And that's probably the biggest, single biggest, on a global scale, effect from this is the change in securities, the security stance by Japan, because it's an economically very powerful country, but militarily not so much. So we'll see if that changes in the next few years. Yeah, and a reminder once again in terms of events that we have early in the morning Pacific time on Tuesday, we have the January 6th hearing coming up. And then probably in prime time in the early evening on Thursday as well. That has not been formally announced yet, but it's expected to be announced on Monday.
All right. So program your TiVos accordingly.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's pretty much all the time we got for this week. But
we'll be back next week.